All right, well, we're back in the next little episode here of going through Augustine. And give me 1 second here to refresh my screen to see if everything looks good on this end. And where do we leave off? Well, we left off at on Christian doctrine. And I got on a couple of rants, and that they weren't bad rants, but at the same time, they got me a little bit off the track of my agenda. So if we have time, we'll tie up some of those loose ends tonight. But I just wanted to, speaking of loose ends, talk about the rest of what Augustine took from Plato, and then start to make it practical. But we do have to kind of complete our grammar stage here and just get a sense of the lay of the land. If I haven't made it clear, abundantly clear already, one huge difference between Augustine and Plato right off the bat. You remember that Aristotle had those two criticisms of Plato's idea of the forms. The second one, if you remember, was how on earth does this realm cause this realm? Well, Augustine's answer for that is the Christian answer for it. We call it creation ex nihilo, that God, by his word, his decree, causes all that is. Okay, ex nihilo just means from nothing. And we'll defend that idea a little bit later, but not tonight. But it's a difference. So here's what I have on the board, just because it makes it much clearer. And three different expressions of really the same thing. This is what I would do in my philosophy classes at our academy, called it the Academy. Wasn't naming it after Plato, I was naming it after the Genevan Academy of Calvin. But anyway, what we had on there for years as we taught philosophy, we did it historically. So we did ancient 1 year, we did medieval the next year, then early modern, then late modern. And so in that first of the 4 years, we talked about, we just introduced this line. And this line followed us everywhere else we went, all the way through Kant and everybody else. Whether they agreed with it or not, because this is really defining everything. Remember the modern philosopher Alfred North Whitehead that said that all philosophy after the ancient Greeks is but a footnote to Plato. Well, that's an overstatement, but there's a truth in it, in that this understanding of the invisible versus the visible is something that does follow us around. Now, what mainly concerns us there is something that the Christian needs to get a hold of, and that there's a lot of criticisms of Platonic thinking or Gnostic thinking or dualistic thinking or Greek speculative thinking. And so, and some of this comes from modern theology in general that tries to make God more relatable by pulling him down from the heavens and, you know, getting rid of all the classical, static, impersonal attributes. Is so much wrong thinking there. But a lot of people that even are not aware of those discussions and those debates will just sort of catch this secondhand in other, bottom shelf kind of books that throw around words like that, but that's just Greek thinking or stuff like that. So Plato's got a really bad rap. Now, we disagree with Plato about a whole bunch of things, but the fact that the soul is immortal, that the soul is invisible, that your mind actually is what gets you in touch with realities outside of your mind, doesn't mean it's the only one, and we disagree with Plato about that. But we don't disagree with him about the idea that the invisible is greater than the visible. I distinctly remember hearing that from Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18, and so on. So, you know, be careful who you listen to when you start to hear this over, just bludgeoning Platonic thought. You know, you're probably dealing with some anti-intellectualism of one kind or another. And a lot of what's motivating it is some of that 19th century liberal stuff that people don't realize that they're inheriting from liberal theology. Anyway, rant. Let me get back to this. This is grammar. Being, good, essence. That's above the line. That means that's in the invisible, eternal realm. Plato would have called it the realm of the forms. Remember, Augustine fixed all that. He said, Plato, those are just attributes of God or ideas in the mind of God. Romans 1:20. Everything down here, remember? The invisible things of him are clearly perceived through what? The things that have been made, so that the form of everything has instances or examples. And so all the predicates and properties we have, whether material or whatever else, is ultimately about God. Yes, the physical things too. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and so on. What does that apply to? It applies to everything once you strip it down. We just don't engage in that kind of abstract thinking that queries things down, strips them down the way Socrates did in his dialogue. That's a little bit easy. Well, it's easier to conceptualize about things like a just war versus an unjust war. And, you know, we talked about the Euthyphro. That's a famous way to do it. But the fact of the matter is that applies to everything. Everything, subject, that has things about it or is in relation to things. All those things that belong to a thing or that are about that thing, if they're not God, that thing, you better keep shooting higher because they're actually about God. Okay? So that's the correction that Augustine gave to Plato. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to get into the rest of Augustine's metaphysic. Not so much worried about Plato right now, because at any point if you say, well, he just got that from Plato, just sort of this knee-jerk reaction. He just got that from Plato, and he just got that from Plato. Look, that's called the genetic fallacy. Just because somebody, you know, what did you learn your times table? From mommy, right? Well, mommy's a sinner. Well, I guess we, come on. You don't think like that in other areas of life. It's just when your emotion comes into it and you don't want to believe something, you go searching for some way to dismiss that thing. And in this particular case, it's called the genetic fallacy. A proposition or a set of propositions is wrong because of where you got it, because of, you know, where it came from. And that's horrible thinking. So, Augustine, his earliest battles were against a group called the Manichees, the Manichaeans. And he actually, when he was still teaching in Hippo, this is before he even went to Milan and Rome, he sort of fell in with the Manichees. They were the school of thought that got him away from mommy. Speaking of mommy, a lot of times when we rebel intellectually or we go back to Rome or to Eastern Orthodoxy or to the Libertarian Party or to the you know, the latest thing, the YouTube videos or whatever else, it's a form of rebellion. We're just lashing out against the guy that just was the wall that represented most nearly God to me, and I'm just kind of lashing out. That's what we do. It's a little deconstruction for you. Well, Augustine did that, and he fell into this group called the Manichees, the Manichaeans. And they believed a lot of weird things, but at the heart of it is they had this whole scheme of sort of light and darkness, sort of like Star Wars, except, you know, obviously light good, you know, darkness bad. But how do you know that? It's just kind of like yin and yang. And that's exactly what it was. It was dualistic, but it was equal and opposite dualism. So it's dualism with a capital D. So you can't say dualism like this. A lot of people will say, Plato, that's dualistic. And they have a big problem with this. But in actual dualism, you got to turn that on its side to yin and yang. Because as C.S. Lewis made the argument in Mere Christianity, you have no objective way to say that which one is good and which one's bad, except for one of them doesn't happen to, you know, please your private fancies, I think is the way he put it. And so dualism, because they're just two equal and opposite powers. Well, a lot of the Manichaean thinking took Platonic thinking in a very Gnostic way. And it affected the way that they dealt with matter, the way that they dealt with pleasure, the way that they dealt with asceticism, and how to defeat sin and defeat evil. Long story short, eventually Augustine got to this point where they just had, they didn't have answers to all of his questions. How do you explain creation? How do you explain that things are good or have a good end, or that good is greater than evil if you have this utter duality? And eventually one of their great teachers that everybody was sort of playing up, a guy named Faustus, came to Hippo, and he was really excited. He, during the 380s, when he was just starting to teach, all right, this guy Faustus is going to come, and he's going to explain everything. And Augustine was totally unimpressed and disappointed. The guy barely knew his classics, and he, at the end of the day, he just didn't have any answers. And so Augustine goes on a journey away from the Manichaeans, and what helped him were the Neoplatonists. And so he started to bring in all these ideas. And so it was a step in the right direction. He had to fix things. And so, in a nutshell, how do they fix all that was wrong in Manichaeanism? Well, let me read you a quote first, and then I'll show you how that plays on this board here. And the quote comes from one particular, not a biographer, I guess he was a church historian that did a book on a nice little book, a short book on Augustine, his thought, a guy named Henry Chadwick. And he summarized Augustine's view over here, especially so you can look at this while I say it. It's a mouthful. It's a tough quote. I won't lie to you here. But I'll draw as I write. Let's see if we can multitask here. Make it easy. Chadwick says this, and he's summarizing Augustine's view. Creation, remember ex nihilo, boom, so it's coming this way, right? So being, the one who has the power of being in himself, is creating something. Doesn't matter whatever it is, it's going to obey the principle. Okay? Creation is participation in being. Stop. So, in addition to these two B words, we're going to introduce two P words. And the first one's going to be participation. Think of this, once we get over here, we'll introduce aesthetic elements of this as well. Think of this word, and where do I want to put it? Think of this as light coming down like this, and sort of a reflection of that light back to this being. I made this a dotted line on purpose. Just follow along. And I'm going to call this upside participation. What do you mean participation? I mean participation in being. What do you mean participation in being? Well, I mean like that light reflecting this. That light, forget about the tabletop or whatever it is that's reflecting the light just for a second. The very light and the color that's hitting your eyes, those particles, that is derived being, participation in being. I'll just let Chadwick talk and we'll catch up. Creation is participation in being. This term implies derivation. It's derived. It's real, but it's not as real. It's kind of ing. Right? It is characteristic of that which is derived. That what one has is then distinct from what one is. So this thing, whatever it is, has predicates, various things. In this case, roundness. But let's say it's the table. Wood, light particles. It's got all the molecules. You know what it has. Those things are predicates. It's over there. Position. That's a predicate. All those properties that you're thinking of as properties, material particulars, and predicates, things that belong to it, whether relationally or something else. Those are things that belong to it. However, if you were to take a ball and it was blue and you painted it red, would it still not be a ball? Yes. And so this gets into the difference between essence versus what accidents. What is accidental to it? We don't use that word anymore. What is secondary? Okay. And so what Chadwick is saying is that in anything that comes to be, that it is. So let's say the table is. And then you got a bunch of stuff here that you could just kind of shift and plug into there. Just sort of revolving door. All the different predicates that you could put in there, just shift another one in, shift another one in, shift another one in. You could take one away and it would still be a table. You could take some others away if you took enough of them away and it wouldn't be anything. But tableness would be made of those things. And those things are always distinct from what Aristotle would call the substance, the particular thing. Okay? I'm interrupting Chadwick a lot only just to make it simple and pictorial. Okay? So he says, when you're dealing with these thingies over here, which is everything besides God, what one has is distinct from what one is. For creatures, it is one thing to exist and another to be just or wise. Right? Have you ever got stupider? Maybe not, but have you got smarter? Sure you have. And so did you become a different being altogether? No. Okay, and so you can add wisdom and you can take away wisdom. You can add height. You can add weight. And you can add other things or whatever else, but you still are. You see the point so far? Now let's move on. But in God, to exist is to be. Therefore, I added language there. Therefore, to be is to be just. To be good, to be wise are all one and the same. Man can exist without being just or good or wise. God cannot. God is what he has. Now, the way Thomas would later talk about this is that, a lot of thinkers, even the Muslim philosophers would have said this, how do I want to say this? There's so many different ways to say it. Essence and one of the ways we said it last time is all that is in God is God. But why is that philosophically? It's because God is all that he has. I'll go with that. God is all that he has. It's indistinguishable. We call that the simplicity of God. But it's based on that fact that he is the only one who simply is. That here's another way to say it. His essence is to be. Whereas for everything else that is participating in being, its essence is not to be, as you start taking away some of those predicates and so on. You get that sense. There's that subject. There's a real distinction between subject and predicate versus in God, where we would call that a logical distinction only. Okay? So that's the first thing, participation in being. By the way, if I was to take away one of those things, I'm going to introduce the second P word. I wasn't going to do it here, but it's a good place to do it. If I was to take away, I don't know, take a sander to that table. If I was to take away some of those predicates or particles or anything else, then I'd have another P word. So this is the light side. Here's the dark side of the moon. Except here it's falling away from being. We call that privation. This will be important for Augustine's Nature of Evil and Origin of Evil, if you've ever struggled or wrestled with that conundrum. Augustine has an answer. And it starts right here with this grammar. Okay, so God alone has the power of being within himself. There must be simply one who is. Now, we haven't demonstrated that through natural theology as you would if I was teaching on Thomas Aquinas. It'd be like one of the first things you talk about. But if you're interested, on my Reformed Classicalist page, go to the Doctrine of God class, and after the first two sessions introducing natural theology and talking about the knowledge of God or agnosticism, whatever I called it, there's five straight sessions that talk about these five arguments I made for God's existence, and the second one especially on the cosmological argument, Thomas's version of it, just watch that. And you'll see why there must be one being whose essence is simply to be, because all other things are contingent and so on, and that creates problems for all of existence. So you're just stuck with this, okay? But watch that if you are interested. Now, one implication of that is that being equals goodness. Now, you know, what do I mean by that? Well, let's keep going in the thinking, because if God is the only necessary being, right, and he's the cause of all that is, on what basis does he create everything else? Think about that for a second. If God is going to have an end in decreeing things exist outside of himself, from what basis, from what set of ends can he draw? And of course, the answer is nothing outside of them, right? Because there is nothing outside of them. Now, this will have massive implications for everything, but one of the things that this will have massive implications for is your understanding of good and evil and moral praise and moral blame in how you assess, why did God do this? Or why is there suffering in the world? Why is there evil in the world? Problem of evil type stuff. And so what Augustine came to see is two very controversial things. One is you can't possibly argue logically in an intelligent way, if you understand that, against the way things, plural, are. All things are good in that end and God's reason for them. Perhaps more shockingly, if I can say it in the shocking way, and then we'll kind of draw back and see what this means and doesn't mean. Everything that is good. Wait for it. Insofar as it is. So that sounds like mysticism. What are you doing? That can't. You're trying to get out of something. No, because what a God, and he would say that about the devil too. And about hell. And about suffering. How? One way to think that is just fall back on, you know, like Romans 8:28. That's how. Because God will bring the best possible scenario up, and that's true, but why is it true? Okay, well, this is the philosophical answer for it, okay? Because that something is owing only to God. And as we've already seen, the only possible end that the first cause of all things could have for all that he did is all that is in him. And therefore, there can't be any other reason for that thing to be other than a good reason. Let's draw that back as far as moral approbation and disapproval of things. You cannot disapprove of anything on any other ultimate basis than the being of God. Because, let's say you want to up the ante all the way and criticize God for something. On what basis will you do that? By the way, this is where the presuppositionalists are right to say by what standard. But I'm going to mean something philosophical by that. It's actually a good response. You know, like when Doug Wilson silenced, what's his name, Christopher Hitchens, and Hitchens said, that's a good question. And Wilson said, I know. We don't fault presuppositionalists for the form of that comeback. I think we can fault them for saying it like a broken record and not explaining what they mean by it. But having said that, by what standard? Let's think about that for a second. It's because of this. Now, what do you mean by that? Okay. What would you have to know that God ought to have done something other than what he did? What is this parallel? And it can't be parallel, because that's dualism again. What is this alternative, and have to be higher? What is this transcendent moral standard that you have access to? So it's another thing you need, is you need, it needs to be knowable, it needs to be objective, it needs to transcend God, and it needs to be real. What other real universe, higher than God, are you aware of? And you've been holding out all these years on me, that you are using as a standard that what God did is not measuring up to. Okay, you see what you need here. It's not logically possible. And going back to Anselm's argument, that thing would be God if there was such a thing. It doesn't work. Okay? So, this is not just Plato just like making up stuff and, you know, being equals goodness. Yeah, that'll work. That'll float. And then Augustine comes around and puts Bible language on it. No. There's no possible way things... First of all, when I say the words way things ought to be, what am I saying? What does the word way mean? Way has to be being, or it weighs nothing. It's a play on words. It's worth nothing because it is nothing. And if it is, if you don't mean something being by way things ought to be, then you mean absolutely nothing, and you might as well have said nothing, because you did say nothing. You just wasted our time and used a bunch of sound waves to do it. Okay? So, being must equal goodness. The ultimate standard of being, the ultimate standard of good is that which simply is, and there's no logical way around that. Okay? I can't belabor that point all night. I know that's, that's probably brain bending. I get it. So, we're just introducing the grammar here. As I said, that'll have implications for morals. It did in his debate with the Manichees. He says, for example, in his book On the Nature of Good, it was one of his early writings, he's writing against the Manichees. He says, the highest good, than which there is no higher, sounds Anselmian there, doesn't it, is God. And consequently, he is unchangeably good, hence truly eternal and immortal. All other good things are only from him, not of him. That's important. Not of him. Not of the same substance. This is not pantheism. This is not, there's no equality here between anything else and God when you're talking about good. Okay? For what is of him is him, what is of him is himself. Okay, so you don't want to mix those. And consequently, if he alone is unchangeable, all things that he has made, because he has made them out of nothing, are changeable. See that? Because he made them out of nothing. Let's do this. This will help us when we get to Origin of Evil, which I'll do that next time. What is the nature of all things? Let me back it up. What is the nature of all things before they were made? Nothing. They don't have a nature because they're not a thing. If God makes things out of nothing, ex nihilo... And supposing, get that sander out again, supposing, Job 34:15, if he should set his heart to it and withdraw his spirit from all things, what? All things would return to dust. Now that's a Hebrew poetic way to say nothingness. Becoming would go to or toward nothingness. Now God upholds things in existence. Okay? He dims the light. He withdraws his operative grace. I don't want to get to that. But if... beings are made ex nihilo, and they're only participating in them to the degree that he upholds them in existence. He upholds the universe by the word of his power, Hebrews 1:3. In him all things hold together, Colossians 1:17. So he's upholding everything by his word. And therefore, it is participating in being. Okay, this is Augustine cleaning up Plato. if he should, he doesn't have to get out of Sander. He simply doesn't speak to that dimming extent. Then, that's kind of built into their nature too, isn't it? That's a hint. And he writes a book called The Free Choice of the Will, which has some problems. If that's also early Augustine. By the way, pay attention to that when you're talking to Catholics. There's an early Augustine and there's a later Augustine. And by the way, a little key to Augustine here is you can divide his life and his career up into polemical segments. So for example, if you're right about here, he gets in there as Bishop of Hippo right there, and he's doing battle against the Manichaeans, right? Right? And so now let's do this, 410, 420, 430. Over here, and it overlaps. It's not a neat total division, but I wrote too big, but you get the idea. Well, it overlaps. Pelagianism, and then of course in City of God against the pagans. But, you know, you can get a sense. Why would I do that? Well, because if he's dealing with this, you know, same kind of thing. People take the church fathers out of context, and sometimes they're just wrong. And other times, they're not talking about what you're talking about. They don't care about your controversy. And so it's anachronistic to read back into their, right, you know, they're doing battle against the pagans about their determinism or fatalism. And so they're asserting the free will in a certain way. Well, Augustine's doing that over here in a particular way. Nevertheless, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there's a lot of stuff that's in there that's very profound. I interrupted his quote, didn't I? Okay, so Augustine says, because, therefore, no good things, whether great or small, through whatever gradation of things, can exist except from God. But since every nature, so far as it is a nature, is good. There's that controversial statement again. It follows that no nature can exist save from the Most High and True God. So every nature, so far as it is a nature, is good. Well, how does any being get its nature? And I'm not talking about once God lets it go to privation. We're not talking about a fallen nature, a corruptible nature, not yet. Wow, this is crucial for so many things. It's not just crucial as you think about the second law of thermodynamics on a piece of fruit. It's crucial for understanding the design versus the distortion in, oh, I don't know, sexuality or government or economics, money. Ew, I feel dirty. Well, your basic problem is that you don't understand these distinctions. You can't call a line crooked unless you have the idea of a straight line. You can't call the image of God bad in every way unless the good design of the image of God is retained still after the fall. Unless you know what the design is. Oh, human government's all wicked through and through. How do you know that? Unless you have the idea of a just ruler wielding the sword, and you've retained that in your mind. And so you've got to be able to make this distinction, okay? You've got to be able to put the scalpel in there and see that a thing, insofar as it is participating in being, is good. What's a synonym for that? This will help you out. That it is doing or being what God has it being or doing is good. Now I'm talking about God's use of that thing, aren't I? Well, yeah, but what would you think was happening in anything that is? God's decreeing and using it for his ends. So be very, very careful that when you criticize things and their nature, that you're not actually criticizing the design rather than the distortion, which you should criticize the distortion, but you have to know what you mean by the design to have the logical framework to do that. Okay, let's get some examples here. Let's really talk here. I don't care about the Manichaeans. I had a bunch of, here's things in their view that this didn't, blah, 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 blah. We already got to that, though. Okay. Let's talk examples so I don't make this irrelevant. and so you got the Augustine timeline thing. Good stuff. Let's take that off. This is already going to be hard enough. Let's make it easy. Okay. So, let's go over here for a second. Let's use one example, and I could use countless examples. But let's use one I used the other night just because it's fresh in my memory. And when I was doing the Heidelberg Catechism, it was question 92. It was on the moral law. You just read the Ten Commandments. It was on Exodus 20, 1 through 17. Why is that the moral law? Now, we're not going to get into all the different things about it, but one of the things I introduced that evening is a distinction that Thomas Aquinas would make famous, but for all of you reformers out there that might be nervous about St. Thomas, let's bring in a guy that took the same framework without much change. He wrote a book in 1593 called The Mosaic Polity, and that's Franciscus Junius. And you might not be familiar with that name, but Junius took the same idea that Aquinas had, and Augustine's breakdown is going to help us. You may not know this, but Aquinas didn't just take Aristotle and dress him up. That's already wrong. But he also appropriated some Platonic categories. That's already true, by the way, in his fourth of the fifth of the five ways. And there's other ways that he does this as well. But another way that Aquinas does that is he draws back on this Augustinian idea of essence and examples and being and participation when he talks about four different kinds of laws. Let me bring my towel over here. That's all right. Yeah, it's nowhere, so I'll use my sleeve. All right. That's messy. So, here's the, let me draw them up here first. Above the line is going to be something called eternal law. Below the line, reflected in the world, are two things covering everything in here. You say it again, covering everything in here. Natural law. And then in a book, hopefully you can see that. I know it's the same color, but anyway. Divine law. And then down here, I'm going to put human law, and I'm going to put XXXX as the timeline goes that way. And these are pieces of human legislation or even written constitutions. It could be fine. Something like that. Okay? So you have these four different kinds of laws: eternal, natural, divine, human. Now, what I was doing the other night, I was talking about the moral law, and that's an aspect of this law which is a refinement, I don't know if that's the right direction, but you get the idea, Calvin used the imagery of spectacles on an old man when he's talking about the necessity of Scripture. He says that, you know, the whole creation is a theater of God's glory, but man in sin is as blind as a mole, right? So I don't have my glasses on me, but anyway, so I had that little prop the other night. I said, but Calvin said that the Scriptures, one of the functions of them is the old man puts the spectacles on and boom, he can see things that are there. That's the key. This is not a Bardian view of Scripture. They don't become true. It's not some encounter with truth that the Spirit lights it up. But what does the Spirit light up? He lights up something that's already true and there, and knowledge, objects of the mind outside of my mind, being, to which my mind will participate in. So the light of that truth, my mind will conform to that truth. Somebody posted this the other day on Facebook. It was a short quote of Thomas Aquinas in the Summa, defining truth. And it's very short. It was, truth is the equation of thought, to being, basically. I think that's the word he used, or to reality. It doesn't matter. Somebody can correct me later. Okay? That's just the correspondence theory of truth, okay? But why does that work? Okay, this is why it works. It's gone. Because my mind is participating in that object of knowledge, which was already an object of knowledge before my mind caught up to it and conformed and agreed with it. Okay? Anyway, sorry. The moral law is the natural law inside that. Where do I get that from? Well, if I get it from Romans 2, 14 and 15, that the Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, nevertheless show that the righteous requirements of God, basically, that is required in the law, the requirements of the law, something like that, is written on their hearts, okay? And so those common notions of moral truths, of the way things ought to be, that God has written on the heart, at Sinai, he put the spectacles on through Moses, okay? But it's not an utterly different substance. The Ten Commandments contains those things that are not that are not what is what God demands of Israel as a kingdom of priests. That's the ceremonial law. But what God demands as of man as the image bearer. Okay? Why was Israel getting that? Because God was reconstituting the human race through a people. Okay? So that's why they were getting a refined version of the natural law in that divine law. What's this got to do with Plato and Augustine? Well, just this. When natural law and divine law, when God requires of you what he requires of you, give you a couple of verses, Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, you are to be holy, for I am holy. This is God speaking. Or Matthew 5, 48, where Jesus says, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Or James 2, 10, that someone who violates one point of the law is guilty of the whole thing, for he who, there's a he behind the commandments, whose nature you violated. Or Genesis 9, 5, and 6, which we'll make a lot of use of, I'm sure, this summer, when I actually do get controversial, where God demands a reckoning for the life of man because God made man in his image. So you see, the two tables of the law are a reflection of God. Even the manward part, the second table, is actually also Godward. It's inside that circle. Everything is what it is because of what it says about God. And every command that he gives you, every imperative, you ought to do that. You ought to be that. You're an image bearer because of what it says about God. And so natural law and divine law, by the way, if you ever hear somebody critique the idea of natural law, I mentioned one critique that's foolish last time. Another one that's silly, but gets more ink in philosophy, and they'll even credit Hume. Even as Christians, they'll credit David Hume for this, which is, you know, okay. It's called the naturalistic fallacy, the is-ought fallacy. That you can't get an ought from an is. You can't get an ought from an is. What do they have in mind? They have in mind something down here, the law of the jungle. Well, it's like what Catherine Newman did to Jordan Peterson. So you're saying that the lobsters should? No, he's not saying that. But that's what they're hearing, is that because something is the way it is, and that tends to work for them, therefore you get an ought. That's not what natural law is. It is not what natural law is. Aquinas said that it is, yes, in us, but it is our participation in reason. Junius even used that more, slightly more Platonic way of saying it than Thomas did. But these things, the nature of moral objects outside of my conscience, writing down on conscience, it's not my conscience, from which moral oughtness is derived. God is writing it on my conscience. It's already an objective obligation. And that thing is what it is because of what it says about God, who is. You absolutely better derive all oughts conceivable from he who is. Did you know that God has a nature? God has a way that he is. And everything is the way it is in moral behavior and obligation because of what it says about God. Okay? Very, 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 very sloppy thinking in people who think that they're going to debunk natural law on this naturalistic fallacy when they're not even understanding the argument correctly. Okay? Okay, so that's that. What's that got to do with really controversial stuff? Now, we're going to get to human law. Oh, I know where this is going, Matt. I know where this is going, and you're even going to quote Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from a Birmingham jail, where he quoted from Thomas Aquinas and Augustine. By the way, did you know that? Did you know that he quoted from Thomas Aquinas and Augustine by name? Well, he knew his natural theology better than most people today do. And it's not the only place he did it, by the way. But a just law is a law that is in accord with the law of God Almighty. And that's not just cheap rhetoric. That's saying that everybody has a what's called a law-legislation distinction. In other words, everybody observes a law above the law. When you're talking about civil law, you say, no, they don't. Positivists posit legal right. And it's not just like a form of right makes right. Might makes right. Except that you're legally creating it out of thin air. Actually, they don't even believe that. How do I know that? Well, before they were in power, they made a case to you, and you bought it, that they ought to be in power. But if their laws were not currently the laws, on what basis did they make that argument? This applies to the Marxists, too. Oh, law is just the creation of the power class, the property class, etc., etc., etc. Marx or Oliver Wendell Holmes or anybody else believes that there is a law that is higher than the civil law of any human beings. That's why they believe that the laws, if you would give them power, that they will make are just, because it conforms to something. Now, they may hide their cards or hold their cards close to their chest and not tell you that, but if you simply ask yourself for 2 seconds, wait a minute. Well, why should I make the laws that you want to make? Well, because, and whatever they say to end that sentence, they're going to be giving you their law above these laws. So, let's say you don't believe in natural law. Yes, you do. Joe Biden made fun of Clarence Thomas in 1991. It wasn't just about Anita Hill. Oh, did you guys want to get controversial? Joe Biden made fun of him. Because who on earth believes in natural law anymore? Well, Clarence Thomas did. And the people who drafted the document that last time I checked, he was up for the job to exegete their meaning, they kind of believed in natural law too. But here's the catch. So does Joe. You can't not believe in some form of natural law because you have some reason that transcends the temporal existence of that law. Unless that law that you want me to pass for the first time has always existed. But of course, if it's always existed, why are you talking? So it is self-contradictory. And from a Christian perspective, we can happily say that we do believe in a law above the law. By the way, they had to argue this way at the Nuremberg trials as well to the Nazi officers who fired back. Well, we were just doing what we were told. Or, well, come on, that's the law of your country and in the laws of our country in Germany. It was perfectly right to do that. And you're just exercising might makes right now. You allied powers and your prosecuting attorneys are just giving us the legal version of that maxim in history, that history is written by its winners. You guys are just writing what is right and wrong by its winners. Well, whether they believe it or not, the prosecuting attorneys at Nuremberg had to appeal to a law above the law, a law that stood over both victors and the vanquished alike. So in that many, many other ways, you're just stuck with this, okay? But when this happens, these are more nearly approximating, if they are just laws, or if that war is a just war, or if that ruling is a just ruling, that ruling and that war and that piece of legislation is more nearly approximating the form of justice which you derived from reason and revelation. See my first lecture on natural theology to see why these two are not in competition with each other. Your reason, your moral reasoning, was participating in the form of justice in God Himself. There's a lot there, and more can be said. But what we're going to do is I think next time we'll be ready to start tackling the city of God. And what a time to start tackling the city of God. You know, Augustine starts that book by what inspired him to write it in 410 as the armies of Alaric sacked Rome, the Goths, and they, this was one of two sackings of Rome, and society was falling apart, and the pagans, of course, blamed the Christians. And if you're familiar with that argument, we'll get into it. But isn't that interesting? When all hell breaks loose, when everything in society becomes disordered, and those whose worldview is fundamentally disordered because they have an seemingly infinite amount of ultimate reference points. But they blame the Christians. And you can start to hear a little bit of the rumblings of that right now. So I think it's a great time to hear from Augustine from that that critical or that polemical perspective as he launches back against the pagans. But then it turns into this positive vision of God's dealing with all of history and what the church is and the Christian pilgrimage as he looks to his chief end, calling even the Romans that he has to argue against and be persecuted by, and make an appeal to them to join this city. So that's where I'm going next, and we'll be there for a couple of weeks, because like I said, I'm already reading some of Augustine's books, but we'll also get into that whole origin and nature of evil thing as well. So that's where we're going next, though. We'll start to tackle the city of God. So till then.